Blog Talk Radio.
United this Sunday evening. Got a great show tonight. We have Academy Award nominated film editor Chris Tellefson with us tonight. How are you, Jerry?
I'm fine. That was very good the way you did that. I like that. That was very impressive.
I'm trying to juggle four or five different screens. So.
No, I hear you. That was
a Chris Walken delivery, though, wasn't it?
That was a classic Chris Walken.
Chris Tellefson? Yeah.
That was great. Awesome. I'm so jealous of you. You've seen Prometheus. I've seen a lot, too, but you've seen Prometheus, so.
Yeah. Well, you'll be seeing it Friday, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, I'll see it Friday, but I mean, I have to say of all, I mean, there are a couple really cool movies before The Dark Knight Rises, but I would say Prometheus may be the most high-profile movie.
Uh-huh.
Well, all right, I take that back. Savage isn't The Amazing Spider-Man, but Prometheus is definitely up there, the curiosity factor is just overwhelming.
Yeah, Prometheus was on my, probably my five must-see of the year.
Mm-hmm.
People in France have seen it. It's been open in foreign markets.
Well, they're lucky. I mean, everyone's lucky these days. Us Americans are ranking pretty low on the totem pole lately.
Yeah. But Prometheus, such a visionary movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad that Ridley Scott returned to sci-fi, and I can't wait to see what he does with the continuation of Blade Runner, too, because the purely imaginative visual design of this movie, I mean, just down to every prop and costume, not to mention the worlds that they create, it's just jaw-dropping. I mean, that really took me, took hold of me more than anything.
That's awesome. That's great to hear. That's what we expect. I mean, kind of what we've got, but it's
and the effects are outstanding. In that, I don't know. I can guess which ones are digital. Obviously, the planets and all of that kind of stuff are digitized. But in terms of creature effects, it all looks so practical, and all the oozing effects and that kind of thing. It's phenomenal work. So on a technical level, it's brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Although I don't necessarily think that he utilized 3D as well as he could have.
That's what I'm hearing. That seems to be a common theme in the reviews.
Which surprised me from a visual director like him and his foray into 3D technology. But I mean, he doesn't utilize the depth as much as he could. I'm not talking about gimmicks, but, I mean, the thing that makes 3D, when it works, when it makes it so immersive, it's because of that depth that you feel. This movie might as well have been in 2D. I mean, it generally looks 2D for most of the movie, even when you're wearing the glasses. And in terms of story, it's very ambitious. I would say, you look at Ridley Scott's two other forays into sci-fi, and those are great classics, with Alien and Blade Runner. I would say that this is an amalgam of both of those because it has the kind of the ooziness and moments of great intensity like Alien.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, it's very existential like Blade Runner.
Okay.
It's very much who are we, what makes us human, where did the human race go wrong, blah, blah, blah. And that's the section of the story which isn't entirely successful. It's not
Oh, okay.
It's not developed quite as well as it should be. You know, I think all, especially in the subtext of faith and how faith comes into play, Noemi Rapace has is a woman of faith, and I don't think that that's just paid lip service to.
Okay.
And that could have been an interesting development in the script had they delved further into it.
Okay.
And that cold dichotomy between, you know, being a scientist and having faith and what she's faced with and how that might challenge her faith. I mean, they wanted it. They wanted the story somewhat to represent that that subplot,
mm-hmm.
but it just didn't feel very developed.
Yeah, when I asked you a question, you said something. You said creature. Okay, so that's an interesting word that you use because that's something we haven't, you know, at least in the trailer, we don't. So there are creatures in this.
Well, I mean, there are space beings. And, I, you know, I don't think I'm giving away any...
No, you're not. You're not. I mean, it's what we... That's what a lot of people... I mean, that's what people, I think, everyone... From that last trailer or the international trailer, everyone's expecting it. So, I mean...
Yeah.
It was it's a very good choice of words, though, creature.
I mean, they're traveling up there to find something.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not going to spend 2 hours of a movie and not find anything.
No, I agree. So, I know. No.
Obviously, they find something. And the effects are very good.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might be a little too, what's the word for it? Maybe a little too artsy-fartsy, mm-hmm. hoity-toity for mainstream audiences.
Right,
past that first week. But it does end on a note that would get...
Well, what's that? What's that? Is that me or you?
What? What happened?
I hear I don't know, so maybe it might be my phone. I don't know, I hear like a that.
Oh, I didn't hear it.
Okay.
But it does end on a note that would make any kind of alien fan really excited, I think.
Okay.
So there's my Prometheus review.
That's an awesome review. That's a good review. I mean, you definitely piqued everyone's interest with that.
I mean, it's the kind of movie that feels very overwhelming as you watch it, and upon reflection... you start to delve into the meaning of it. And honestly, I mean, some of it I don't quite understand at first viewing. So it is a movie I'll be going back to. And maybe
not.
Maybe it's all there and I just didn't absorb it all.
That's the impression I'm under. I mean, just reading some of the reviews, it does sound like something you have to go back and watch again because there's a lot to look at and grasp. But
Performance-wise, Michael Fassbender is great.
That seems to be the as far as the human performances go, that seems to be the irony is the guy playing a robot is the most human person
yeah.
in the film.
He's very graceful physicality to him. I mean, he's wonderful in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very, very friendly and menacing all at the same time.
Okay.
So it's you know, it's obviously well worth watching. Any
of oh, yeah,
Scott
of course,
basically
yeah.
is.
Mm-hmm.
And it does have ties to Alien. I mean, I can understand they're trying to walk a tightrope here because they know that it has ties to Alien, but it's not Alien. I mean, it's a completely different experience. So
mm-hmm.
they don't want to sell it as a sequel, prequel of Alien.
Right.
But they definitely want to sell the fact that it has ties to Alien.
Mm-hmm.
I think Ridley Scott was smart the way he described it by saying that, you know, we took some initial inspirations from Alien and we found that we were going off in our own exciting direction
mm-hmm.
that was unexpected to us. So I'm sure it'll be a big hit. What was Snow White the big hit this weekend?
Yeah, Snow White. I don't know what to make of Snow White. It's, you know, it's good. I mean, I never saw the other Snow White movie, so I have no idea. You know how to compare it to that, but I was shocked because I had no idea. It's like the anti George Lucas movie. They got real actors to play dwarves in the movie. I had no idea about that. I mean, they got like Ray Winstone, Bob Hoskins, and
well, they're not dwarves, are they?
Yeah, no, they're not dwarves, but they're playing. And I was like, I had no idea about it. I didn't know much about this movie. I was like, watching, like, really? Oh, my God. They cut out all those people for jobs and everything. So.
Wow. But I hear that Kristen Stewart isn't a very effective Snow White, is what I heard.
I hate that. I like Kristen Stewart. Like,
I like her too.
Adventureland and everything, but she looks like she's taking so much Valium during the movie. I'm sorry, she does.
A pouty Snow White.
Oh God, she's the least interesting part of the movie.
That's too bad.
That is. I like her a lot, and it's just not. She's not there. It seems like she's. So.
She wasn't in that, was she? I'm not there.
No, she was not. That was.
Meanwhile, MIB is doing okay. MIB 3. That's at 112 million after this weekend in domestic,
mm-hmm.
Which isn't bad.
It's not a bad movie. It's a fun movie. I mean, it was much better, like as we said, than the second one. I mean, so.
I liked it a lot. You know what? And whenever on opening weekend, when your movie makes $150 million worldwide in
right.
3 days, and that's considered disappointing. I mean, it's
what
ridiculous.
Kind of world do we live in?
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
Avengers, meanwhile, is now the third biggest domestic grosser of all time.
Wow.
Yeah, I think worldwide of all time. It's still got a ways to reach Titanic or Avatar
mm-hmm.
even further, obviously. But I think it's at. I don't know where it's at.
It's incredible. I would never have guessed that it would. Do this well. Never dawned on me it would do this well.
Amazing. But I guess because the summer started on that enormous high,
mm-hmm.
that everything that comes after it is just bound to be a disappointment, gross-wise. So,
mm-hmm.
Oh, man, we're down from the Avengers. Well, the Avengers was you know, a one-of-a-kind kind of event. It's the
mm-hmm.
third biggest movie of all time. I mean, not every movie can be that.
No, it can't. I don't know. I mean, I would imagine the next. I mean, honestly, I think the next movie that obviously is either Spider-Man or The Dark Knight, and I don't think it's going to be Spider-Man. I think it will be The Dark Knight will be the next movie that really.
Yeah. Now, is Spider-Man part of that? Spider-Man's Marvel. Is the Avengers, are they all DC or something?
The Avengers is all Marvel and Spider-Man is Marvel, but actually Spider-Man is owned by Sony, but Spider-Man is actually, I think, part of the Avengers or something, but because Sony owns it, there's all this litigation or something that, I mean, I don't know. That's what I keep hearing.
All I'm saying is stick Spider-Man in the next Avengers. And that's, I mean, stick Spider-Man in anything.
I think Sony has to give it up or something. That's the thing.
Oh, okay.
That's always been a, because I think he is supposed to be, if I'm not mistaken, in the Avengers, but because.
Put Spider-Man in the best exotic Marigold Hotel.
That's
major. Meanwhile, have you heard about this? This is like best exotic Marigold Hotel,
mm-hmm.
which I'm not crazy about the title. Even though that might be exactly what it's about, but it is the art film hit of the year. It's already worldwide. It's grossed $100 million. It's the seventh highest grossing movie so far in Fox Searchlight history, and a completely unexpected surprise.
I had no idea. I mean, I've seen it. It's kind of a bleak movie.
Oh, is it bleak?
It has some bleak moments. No, but it is part of that tradition of feel good. Let's put, you know, how shall I say it? This tradition of putting, let's put British old people in these different situations. But it has some bleak moments in it. But 100 million, really?
It's done very well. But here's
here's
what I'm thinking. I mean. I would imagine this is probably akin to the same crowd that made Midnight in Paris such a smash. I love Midnight in Paris. I love Woody Allen.
Right.
But I've always been kind of curious, why Midnight in Paris of all his movies?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's an excellent Woody Allen movie, and there are some bad ones out there. But
yeah.
it is completely a Woody Allen tone.
Right.
And so for people to avoid most of his other movies and flock to this one, what was it about this one? Do you think that these two movies are catering to an older crowd? Is an older crowd just starved for movies to go out
yes,
to the theater to see?
I do believe that.
Because we always hear about the teenage demographic, and that's what drives the movies and the box office
mm-hmm.
and everything.
I do. I think you're on to something. I do think, because Midnight in Paris also deals with this thing about going back in time, or you know, your youth and everything, and going back to what you think is a better time and everything. I think that hit a chord with people. With this one, though, I mean, it's a good movie. It's not a great movie, but I guess it appeals to a, it definitely in its own way appeals to a, it's smart movie making, or maybe not smart movie making, but smart marketing. Because you do have to, really, if we're, every, the thing that you hear over the years is that this is the population, not just in the U.S., but everywhere, is graying. You really do have to cater to this audience, and that's something that, unfortunately, Hollywood is not good at. They always cater to that, that prime demographic, the 18 to 35-year-old or whatever.
Right.
And they really do have to start thinking a little bit better, much better.
Right.
And this is part of it. The indies seem to do this better than anyone else.
I think if you want to, because they're always trying to appeal to every single demographic possible in a single film. So in order to do that, we've already said that they should put Spider-Man in the next best Marigold exotic hotel thing.
That would be a smash of epic.
And then in turn, just put a bunch of old people in the next Avengers. I think that's the perfect balance.
I think you're right.
Get them all in there. Okay. Let's play our first interview of the evening. We have an Oscar-nominated artist on the show tonight, Jerry.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't you or I.
No, but he's made some. He's edited some great films. I mean,
oh, outstanding! Chris Tellefson, Academy Award nominated earlier this year for his work in Moneyball, one of the great movies of 2011. And I mean, one of the most diverse editors you can think of. I mean, he's gone from, let's say, he's gone from Flirting to Disaster, The People versus Larry Flint. He's gone from Gummo to Analyze This. You know, it's just a wide breadth
just
of
Gummo
range.
Just Gummo on the resume alone. I mean, wow.
Yeah, I mean, from wildly experimental to, you know, very straight narrative, but inventive and highly entertaining narratives. I mean, he can do it all.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Kids, Larry Clark's film Kids.
Yeah, I mean, there's another. That's another. I mean, Kids and Gummo and. I mean, these are all very, such diverse films. Wow.
Yeah, but let me tell you why he's on. He's on because our great friend, Bobby Yosin, she's been on the show many times. She's, because she hosts various events, and Inside the Cutting Room is the name of her series. And what it is, it's she kind of moderates, she brings on a guest editor, and there's a Q&A on stage, and they play clips from that editor's career, and they delve into the ins and outs and the why this cut, why that cut, and then they have the audience participate with their own questions. It's a great event. And this weekend, Saturday, June 9th, Mr. Tellefson and Bobby will have their event at EditFest New York.
Cool.
Which is a great event. If you go to editfest.com, you can find a complete schedule. And I highly recommend attending this event. I mean, Bobby's the best there is.
She's wonderful.
Bringing to light, you know, the art of editing and the importance of editing, and actually helping people understand what it entails and what an essential component of the filmmaking process it is. So here is Mr. Tellefson talking about Moneyball and a whole lot of other stuff. Enjoy it, guys. But first of all, I'd like to know from you, what was it about the editing process that that spoke to you, that felt like a good fit for you?
Well, I was an art student. I went to Cooper Union in New York City in the late 70s, and I was an art major. I took many different things. I took photography and painting and sculpture and some multimedia things eventually, but what I had always loved movies, and I would have always watched them sort of obsessively, essentially, and but I'd never had any context of or thought of going to film school or anything like that. It just didn't have a context of it as something that I would do. And by my third year at school, I took an experimental film course. It's a sort of cross between experimental film and animation course with Robert Breer, the abstract filmmaker and painter. And I just something sort of clicked. There was a Steinbeck, the little four-plate Steinbeck, and I would just sort of made these collage films from shooting, like, I would stick a Bolex on a little sliding, it wasn't really quite a dolly, it was something that was usually used for animation, and I'd put it in front of a television, and I would scan the TV guide for shots that I even remembered from certain films and stuff, and made these kind of collage films from things that I pieced together from bits that I used pieces of the Douglas Sirk film Written on the Wind and some other films that I loved, and I loved certain shots from, and I also integrated things from science programs and Spanish soap operas and television commercials. I just started having fun with it. It was just like, I just, the whole aspect of like what it just felt like putting two images together, and the kind of the energy of a cut had kind of just clicked for me, and it was like I just have a feel for this, this feels good. I like doing this, and if I'm going to do something, this is what I want to do, and it sort of like usurped any other mediums that I was interested in pursuing as on a more long-term career as opposed to a student, and I just very, very aggressively pursued it because I figured it was what I really wanted to do.
You're talking, as you are, about starting kind of in the abstract experimental vein. Do you find that you call upon that style of editing a lot in the kind of conventional narrative films that you edit now?
Well, there's certain films that they completely spoke of that. That was Gummo. Gummo was that mm-hmm. all over the place. It was like that was like a fish in water with Gummo. I just enjoyed the process so much. And it was right after The People versus Larry Flint, which was very controlled and like multi-cameras and doing a biographical film where you have to like really, really be very, very focused on, you know, what you're putting out. This is a living person, and the whole aspects of the control of something like that. And then like doing Gummo was like a huge, like a projectile vomit of craziness. It was just like, just like dug into it and had a lot of fun. I really love contrast. I like moving from very different things. It's like my last film before the one that I'm working on now was Moneyball. Which what I'm working on right now is a film called Rest in Peace Department, RIPD, with Jeff Bridges, which is mm-hmm. a big visual effects comedy with a lot of animation and like completely CGI characters, and like it's about dead policemen who are scouring the earth for these creatures, deados, who escape judgment and are trying to take over, and it's a lot of fun, and it's a complete like the polar opposite, and I've never dealt with so many visual effects, and we have like teams of visual effects people, and very interesting. It's really, it's a new muscle to flex.
You're absolutely right, because all of these films, as you said, are very different, and we think in terms of our actors and our directors being versatile, but I mean, it seems like versatility is a very important factor for you too.
Well, it's a matter of enjoying it too. I mean, I have no intention of getting pigeonholed into one thing, because I just don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want it to stretch and have something be challenging.
Right. Well, you, very early on, once you kind of started pursuing a career in editing, you kind of apprenticed under Thelma Schoonmaker.
Yes, on The Color of Money.
And she has a very, we've spoken to Thelma, she was a lovely, lovely woman, but she has a very adventurous editing style. What did you pick up from her, from your time with
Thelma,
her?
Thelma's like, you know, it picked up before I met Thelma. I was picking up from her. I mean, Raging Bull is like so seminal, just in terms of like the, you know, no fight movie was the same after that, or any sequence that involved boxing is turned on its head.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Thelma's amazing. You know, she's great, and then Woodstock as well. I mean, and what I absorbed by being an apprentice on The Color of Money, well, seeing the different versions and being able to respond to, you know, to the differences and the, and where she was going with things, it was always very interesting.
And you also talked about her work ethic and how inspiring it was, that intense focus. I mean, to be in the cutting room for the first time.
Yeah, that was very, you know, really, you know, like this is what it's about. I mean, you find it by, you know, you dig, and it takes every which way but where to get there.
Mm. Well, you've worked on a few movies, including one of my all-time favorites, which I want to talk to you about in a little bit, but a few movies that are very kind of dialogue heavy, including
especially like, well, the first feature really that I did.
Right.
Metropolitan, which it's dialogue, you know, I was very drawn to it. When I read the script, I was very taken with it. I was like, this is amazing. It's just so different. I mean, especially to make a low budget movie about high budget people. It was kind of a wonderful kind of contrast, like a conundrum. So I was very drawn to it, and I was really excited about it. And when I first, they had already been shooting for like a week or so when I was introduced and came to the set, and I saw this group of young people that were, and they were filming, and I was just amazed at how comfortable they just looked like a group of people that knew each other for years.
Mm-hmm.
It was just so well cast and thought out.
Well, I'd read that Mr. Stillman was a little hesitant at first of having you toy with the dialogue at all.
But I mean, it was a long, like 140 page script, and it was very it was much more dialogue heavy than it ended up being in the end. But we, you know, when I had a first cut together that was completely, you know, two script, like almost every word, you know, we sat down, it was like, you know, now it's, you know, we have to start shaping this, you know. And he, you know, I would make suggestions, he would like, oh, that's grammatically incorrect, you know, we can't really do that. So I said, well, you know, I think we should show it this, you know, we should have some people over and we should show it, you know, on a 16 millimeter flatbed changing reels. And, you know, by the end of that, it was like, you know, he understood that, you know, we had to shape it. The first scene, actually, interesting, I was going to talk about the scene in there. The very first scene in the movie where Audrey is, like, talking to her mother.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, very short scene. It's only about three shots or something. She just says, you know, like, her brother insulted her that she looked fat in her dress, and then she said, oh, we'll just take it in here. It'll be fine. And then she said, oh, I look horrible, kind of a thing, you know, and she said, oh, no, dear. She does it in, like, in a few words. The woman, Linda Gillies, who played the role, was really, when they shot the scene, it was quite a long scene. It had a lot of dialogue in it. But Linda was a non-professional actor. She wasn't an actor. She was she actually her daughter, Isabel Gillies, is in the film. She played the character Cynthia. But I remember Witt saying, this is going to be like you know, the Urban Haute Bourgeoisie. This is going to be like neorealism. This woman's amazing. She's like, really, she is this. This is what she is. And that was great. But she, the poor woman, was terrified, and she screwed up every line. It was difficult. It was very difficult. But she was lovely, and she had a great presence on screen, but she didn't have a lot of confidence in pulling it off. But I had a cut two script that was difficult, because, you know, she just wasn't nailing it, but I just kept honing that scene and honing and honing and bringing it down to like just like literally three shots, four shots.
Mm.
It got it all across, and she read correctly, and it felt like the right beginning there.
Well, and I would think that, and I guess it ties in with that, it finding a momentum is very important. I think you talk about finding the internal rhythms of a piece.
Very, very much so. It's like the dialogue of, you know, Witt's dialogue is so particular, and finding that kind of like a way to have it really fall off the tongue in a fun way, and things like little wonderful little flourishes, like when a character kind of repeats something in a formal kind of way. It's very particular to that person. Like, maybe someone would cut that, but I didn't cut that. Like, she explains, like, in the bathroom with the other girls, Audrey's talking about meeting Tom outside when they were fighting over a cab, and she says, I don't remember the exact dialogue, but she says it sort of twice in a very formal kind of way, but it's very endearing. It's very lovely. And the lovely actress, Carolyn Farina, who played that character of Audrey was actually doing an accent. She was a young girl who lived, she lived in Queens, and she had a slight, you know, Queens accent, and she had to, like, you know, sort of get the upper crust accent down. She did a beautiful job, but she brought an enormous amount of charm and vulnerability to that character, which was very necessary.
Do you find that performance kind of motivates the cuts that you make more than anything?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Performance is everything. I mean, it's nothing without performance. You can heap as much style as you want on something, but if the performances aren't alive, it's nothing.
Yeah.
And Chris is such an unusual amount of film, done such an unusual amount of films that have non-actors in them, and a combination of non-actors and actors, and the ability to sort of, I'm using a word of his, to massage those performances together to create a whole is really challenging. And
but a real treat, too. It's really fun. There's something you get from sort of non-professionals that are perfect for a role, or that have a certain kind of energy or aura that just, like, is a wonderful thing to integrate. It's just fun.
I'm self-conscious.
Yeah, like the wonderful, all those guys who were scouts, real scouts that were in Moneyball, that, you know, they're just so terrific.
That's absolutely what I was thinking of is Moneyball, because those scenes at the table feel so conversational and almost improvisational.
They were partially so. They had a script that they were going from, but they went off on it. You know, because Bennett really encouraged that. I mean, he set up those scenes to be shot like a documentary, and Wally Pfister shot them. Like he was faced with this, like, you know, Wally's work is very kind of dramatic, and his lighting is usually very dramatic. And here he was with, like, you know, 10 old guys sitting around a table with a fluorescent light. You know, so he figured out the way to do that with there was a lot of coverage, but the most striking shots and the things that we ended up using most were these raking shots, raking profiles, where the focus would shift to the different characters, and they're just beautiful, you know,
yes.
Really beautiful. And, that
and a lot
really
of those people were originally hired as consultants and not intended to be used as actors.
Yeah,
they just evolved.
Yeah, well, Bennett just said, why are we going to hire actors? These guys are amazing.
It absolutely gives a sense of reality to it. Those are actually my favorite scenes in that movie.
Yeah, they're really quite beautiful, and they were a treat to do.
We're actually showing, at NFS, we're showing the second scout scene. And it is really powerful and a very pivotal moment in the movie.
And wonderfully funny, too.
Yeah.
It is very much. That's the scene where he brings Jonah Hill in, correct?
Yeah.
The silent partner.
That's so
you
terrific.
Want me to speak? Yeah, when I point at you.
So, Bobby, you've hosted these panels before with such a distinguished list of guest editors. When you review Chris's filmography, what pops out for you?
Well, I think, first of all, as he spoke about, it's very clear that he stretches himself enormously and is always looking for new challenges and never, as he said, lets himself get pigeonholed. I thought it was interesting that Chris told me that after Flirting with Disaster, he was offered a ton of very bad comedies. Mm. I'm sure it could have been very easy to fall into being pigeonholed at that point, but he never did that. And I also think it's fascinating his art school background and his adventurousness at that point in his life, and it sort of informs his work later. But I also think he actually pointed this out to me, which I think is interesting, that the genre that he's done the most is biography, true stories.
Mm.
And it just evolved that way. But then there's this wonderful contrast of comedy. You know, you have the one he's doing right now, R.I.P.D., but also Flirting with Disaster, which sort of definitely broke ground in comedy in terms of its neo-manic structure. And I think that, you know, analyze this. So there's this incredible range of work, and I think it's, you know, we can talk about courage and taking chances, but then the bottom line is Chris also has this incredible ability, which all great editors have, to find the truth in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and performance is everything, and the sensitivity to performance and the material, and it's pervasive in his work.
Well, comedy interests me, especially from an editing point of view, because it's got to be a tricky process. I mean, how long do you hold for the laugh? When do you punch up the laugh? When do you kind of let it just exist and feel more relaxed? Is that a tricky process for you?
Oh, yeah, but sometimes, you know, it just, like, the rhythm of the delivery, the and what you have, the options you have for responses, you know, because it's usually in an exchange. Those are the kind of things that one looks for to create the rhythms of it.
Well,
timing is everything.
Is the screening process especially important
for comedies? Enormously important. But you don't want to be a total slave to it.
Right.
You know, I think it can be. You can use it to really good effect, and then you can kind of grind something into the ground with it.
Yeah. Well, I understand
It's a delicate thing.
You tested Moneyball, and I understand there was a subplot involving the wife that you decided to excise after that point?
Yeah, there was a lot of setup.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of setup in the beginning to create, you know, the sense that, you know, here's this before he, like, goes to the owner of the team and says, you know, I need more money. I got to have more money. There was a whole thing of him chasing down different agents of the three players that were leaving.
Right.
And within that, also in the scene right after, in the very beginning, when he's in the car and he starts smashing the transistor radio. There was a whole conversation with his wife that was excised there, and then there was a whole scene going, like, they make a decision to go to forget about all this and go to Hawaii, and then there's a whole thing of them in the airport, and he's on the phone with different, like managing on the phone different phone calls with agents of these different players, of Giambi and the other player. And it just was too much setup. It was way too much setup. And then later on in the film, there was just a couple of hits of her. And then there was a very beautiful scene, actually, a beautiful scene with he and his wife that was a dinner scene that was kind of improvised, and they didn't know what the hell it was going to be, actually. They just, Bennett just wanted to shoot something. And it was, Brad and his current wife, just like right after the 20th game, he's just like inconsolable. He's like, she's like, oh, you just won 20. This is amazing. This is so great. And he's like, it doesn't mean shit. It means nothing until if you don't win the last game, you're just a number in a book. It's just, you know, it doesn't mean shit, you know. And so he was, and it was really quite a lovely scene. So when we took out all the setup and we decided to excise the wife, we had that scene to deal with. And because it was such a key and interesting scene, and we had to have something to replace. But the thing was, it really should have been Jonah who he was speaking to at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. So we actually, for screening purposes, we concocted a scene out of, like, with shots of Jonah in the video room, and just voice from Brad, and some images, like holdover images from the 20th game, and utilized the dialogue with the dialogue editor, took out all the sounds of the restaurant, and we got away with it in quite a few screenings, and that was something that, you know, it played well, but we weren't going to finalize the film without, you know, we had a little shoot where Brad did the other side of the scene, but we didn't reshoot Jonah. We kept the cheated shots that were from a different scene.
Wow. Well, that is a major decision, and I could imagine that it would change the perception of Brad's character in the film somewhat.
Well, what it was that we all came to realize was it was more poignant for him to be a little lonelier.
Yeah.
You know,
and then it brought the daughter to the forefront,
enough.
Too.
Exactly.
The relationship
exactly.
with the daughter. Yeah.
Exactly. or maybe brought that way to the foreground, and that was something that was our end pivoted on their relationship. So strengthening that was all the better.
There has to come a time when you make a major decision like that, where you have to be kind of merciless. I mean, you can't be precious about
certain moments. Oh, you're merciless
moments.
Every day with a movie when you're editing. I mean, it's like, you know, every single thing is a decision. You know, like when you have, you know, 30 takes of a reading, you know, you're making a decision.
Yeah.
It's also killing your babies, killing those little gems that you love, and seeing the overall.
It's a constant.
Yeah.
I'm very interested in score, because I read a quote from you where you were talking about oftentimes if you know who is composing a particular film, maybe you'll pull some temps from their previous scores.
Oh, yeah, always. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So how does that kind of elucidate the rhythm of the movie for you?
Well, you know, temp scores are kind of tough. You know, you do everything you can to approximate what the intent of the movie is with things that were created for something else. So it's tricky, it's difficult, and you have to keep looking for tonal likenesses. And if you have, you know, you have the advantage of knowing who your composer is, you can draw a lot upon that, but sometimes that doesn't fill the bill either and you have to look elsewhere. I mean, it's not as if that's an instant, you know, answer to anything. But Michael Dana, who did the score for Moneyball and for Capote, and is truly, truly wonderful and very, very inspired. It's always an interesting process working with Michael because he really evolves it, and we find those places, we find those sweet spots, we find that way to. He's wonderful at creating music that brings that really is almost like thought. That
right.
just brings you into a head. It was like in Capote, he managed to get across in a very particular piece, just like almost the process of writing, the process of creativity. I mean, he's really wonderful, and that was a real treat.
And the score, but particularly your editing, makes all these elements so involving, and elements that you would not think would be necessarily cinematic, because you have to you have stats. You have lots of information coming at you.
Making that, you know, into something digestible and fun at the same time, and visually interesting, and also not overly. We made a decision early, no animation. We weren't going to make this like, you know, all fancied up. We wanted it to feel like hard numbers, like something that was real. You know, that was a very strict decision, and we actually had a designer. Fellow named Johannes Gamble, who did a lot of the stats for us, and he found like a monitor in like a Salvation Army that had these amazing pixels, and that's how it was shot off of something to give it this kind of a wonderful graphic minimal quality, and then it was a matter of finding the rhythms to you know make it and the correct music. Actually, that's not Michael's music. It's a piece called Destroy All Monsters. The Rio Grande is what it's called. Some indie band that actually was that music was brought to us by Johannes, and it just worked so beautifully. And we actually used that in the 20th game at a certain point too.
I like the story you told, Chris, about the underhanded picture footage that was originally in the second scout scene, but it was just a beat too long, and then you were able to integrate it into the statistics scene
great. We weren't using footage. It was just that he was referred to in the scout scene. It made the scout scene a bit too long, like a good beat too long. So and we also felt that we wanted the stats to be a little more personalized, to not just be numbers, but include a human being. So it did make sense to put Chad Bradford into that.
So, Bobby, the event is this upcoming weekend. The panel with Chris, is that on Saturday?
It's on Saturday. It's the next to last panel, which is at 2:15. And the only problem with Chris is there's just too many wonderful movies.
Yeah.
It was really, really hard, and we have probably too many clips. I hope not. We're actually 6 to 7 movies we're covering. If you want the list, I'll give it to you.
Please, please, yes.
Metropolitan, Kids, Flirting with Disaster, The People versus Larry Flint, Capote, Moneyball, and If We Have Time, Analyze This.
Wow.
Yeah, it's, and the contrast is great, but that's the nature of his resume anyway. But they're all, I mean, I just, there's so much to say about every one of them. It's going to be exciting, but we're going to have to talk fast.
That'll be, that's going to be a great, that's going to be a great event. I just know it.
Yeah.
Actually, I wanted to ask you about two projects, one collaboration and one particular film. In your resume, and Bobby touched upon it with The People versus Larry Flint, because I wanted to know about the experience of working with Milos Forman. What in your view makes him unique?
Well, Milos is very interesting in that, you know, his theory of directing is that it's 90% casting, and I think he's very right there. I mean, if you don't have, if your cast isn't 100% there, if you don't have the absolute right people interpreting it, then there's not much you're going to be able to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing with Milos is very, he's tough, you know. He's very, he's exacting. He's not terribly communicative. He kind of, it's like expectations are high, but nothing's really discussed.
I think an interesting story you told about that film was that he shot, the two leads.
Oh, yes, that's interesting, because he really loved the interaction of, Courtney was particularly good at improvisation, and she interacted really well with Woody, and he made the decision to, like, shoot almost all their scenes, like, literally, like, 99% of their scenes are shot with two cameras, so there was always this like rhythm of kind of reaction against one another. And especially with Woody, she would do things that would throw him, and he'd always have this kind of like look of like being kind of surprised by her. And it was a wonderful kind of rhythmic thing that was utilized throughout.
Did you find that the process of editing was different between Larry Flint and Man on the Moon?
Oh, hugely different. And on Larry Flint, it was he and I were like cheek to jowl, like literally. I'd say once shooting was over, because I did a lot of work before shooting was over, and I'd all integrated the movies. But we'd worked together from like 9:30 in the morning to like 11 at night. It was like 5 days a week. It was very specific. And it was, and studio notes would come in, and they would be filed in the trash. And it was very different on Man on the Moon. There were many producers on it, way too many people that were like kind of had a stake in the story of Andy Kaufman.
Mm-hmm.
And he was much more open to intervention, and it was kind of, and it was also a group of us. I wasn't available at first. I was finishing Analyze This. But they wanted me to do it, but I wasn't immediately available, and they had started working months before. So he started with Lindsay Klingman with the idea of me then coming on, and during the time that she was on, and her assistant Adam Boom started working specifically with Milos, and she would work separately. And then when I came on, Lindsay went off, but then Milos and Adam would work together, and then I would work separately, and then the three of us would work together. So it was very different. It was much more of a, it was more collaborative, and there was also more outside intervention.
Mm.
Whereas People versus Larry Flint was very insular. We were extremely insular on that.
Well, I adore both films, but let me tell you, one of my all-time favorite movies, and any time I bring up these hidden treasures, I always bring up this one, is Smoke, because Smoke is so celebrates kind of the joy of storytelling in such a special way for me. And I want to know any information you can give me about the process of working on that.
Really, really beautiful movie. And remember, I was an additional editor on Smoke. I was brought on Smoke after the fact.
Okay.
It was an interesting situation. That year was really, really interesting for me because I assume you're aware of the movie Blue in the Face.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which Blue in the Face, I edited Blue in the Face, but it was an offshoot of Smoke, and Smoke had been like shot and was like in process of being edited at the time. Maisie Hoy was the editor, and they just at the end of shooting, they decided Wayne and Paul Auster had put together this film idea for a film called Blue in the Face, which was like a group of blackouts. They were going to just spend 3 days shooting after the end of shooting of Smoke and just do this kind of crazy movie. And so I got a call through Diana Phillips, one of the producers who I had known from a short that I had edited, and she said, oh, we have this thing, it's sort of Jarmuschian, you come on for a couple of weeks, it's just like kind of in these string of things like held together by the Lounge Lizards and John Lurie. They were going to play music on the outside of the Smoke shop, and then we just to sort of weave it and make it, but it's going to be very simple. So I had just interviewed with Larry Clark for Kids at that time, and I said, look, well, I have this thing pending, I don't know if I'll be able to do it, but I'll come on for a couple of weeks. So I went in and started, and it really wasn't going to work that way, and I started jump cutting it and doing a lot of stuff, and they got kind of excited and they liked that, but then I got Kids and I said, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to finish this. And then they proposed that I do it in conjunction with Kids, so I got Kids, and then I talked to the producers of that, and then I would work on Kids 3 days a week and that for 2 days a week.
Wow.
And so I did them both simultaneously, and during that time, there was some difficulties in terms of, like, Harvey Weinstein wasn't happy with it or something or other, and they felt that they needed, you know, to do a few things with it. They needed to reshape it somewhat or cut it down, but they were resisting what could have been a chop job, because Smoke is so particular. It's like it's Wayne Wang's Ozu film, you know, that's what it really is.
Mm-hmm.
And so they asked me while I was doing these other two projects to do a pass on it, to like, you know, look at it. And so I did, and so I was doing all three at the one time at one point.
Wow.
But but what I was very judicious about Smoke, I cut about 15 minutes, very judiciously cut 15 minutes out of it and worked the music. And Rachel Portman came in and did one extra piece, and then there was some other, like, source music, too. But really, it was very, very particular, and I very carefully worked it to preserve its integrity and its charm.
And that's a beautiful movie.
It is a lovely, lovely film.
And finally, I guess the fun question I have to ask is about your Oscar experience. This was your first time at the Oscars for Moneyball.
Yeah.
Was it overwhelming that evening?
It was weird. It was very surreal. It was very it was really, really weird. But it was fun. I had a good time. I had a good time. It was the red carpet was bizarre. We were kind of late. I went with my family. My entire family came. And, you know, like, we get out, and there's, like, you know, like, we're almost tripping over Meryl Streep, and, you know, kind of, there's, it's just crazy. And that red carpet seems like about four blocks long. Great. And then by the time we got there, there wasn't even, the bar was closing, and we were miserable, and Ron Barr and his wife were there, and she, Leslie had half a glass of warm wine, and we were like, we'll take it, thank you.
That's great. So Bobby, tell our listeners how they can find more information about the event.
Well, if you just Google EditFest New York 2012, you'll get all the information you need. But it's basically on the 8th and the 9th of June. There's one panel Friday night, and then there's four panels the following day. And it's really wonderful because it's a rare opportunity for there's mostly working editors, actually, working filmmakers in the audience, surprisingly. There are students as well, but it's just a great opportunity to really find out what's inside the head of these remarkable editors and learn about the process. Because you really, as I've said many times before, you really never know what goes on in the cutting room unless you speak to an editor and have a sort of show and tell where they can run footage and talk about their process. And it's really a wonderful experience. And the back and forth, the Q&A, is very revealing in that the audience is very informed, the questions are very intelligent, they're very hungry to absorb
mm-hmm.
what the editor has to offer. So I encourage people to go.
Okay, that is Bobby Osteen and editor Chris Tellefson. Their event at Edit Fest New York will take place this coming Saturday, June 9th. You can read more about Edit Fest New York at editfest.com. You can read more about Bobby at bobbyosteen.com. So thank you to both of them. They were lovely. They're terrific.
That was fascinating. That was a really good interview and really good of you to ask about smoke and blue in the face and all. That's just
I love smoke.
Awesome. Awesome.
Did you know that about Did you know that about that whole subplot involving Brad Pitt's wife? Was it even apparent that he was really married when you saw
Moneyball? I had no idea. I mean, no idea.
But that's a prime example of how editing can completely reconstruct
mm-hmm.
the perception of a character in a film, because that character would have come across much differently if we were aware of him having a wife that he confided in.
Right, yeah.
During the film.
No, editors are the unsung heroes of
yeah.
the movies. They always have been and always will be. I mean, they really are. That's really in the editing room. I mean, that's where it all comes together.
Absolutely.
I mean, really.
Well, we're going to close the show in a little bit. We're going to bring on two of the principal players in Secret Handshake Entertainment,
mm-hmm.
Joe Gressis and Jake Hartley. They've started a new contest for filmmakers called the Collaboration Filmmakers Challenge.
Mm-hmm.
You can read more about their contest at collaborationchallenge.com. And then we'll premiere a piece of score from the new Maggie Gyllenhaal film, Hysteria.
Oh, dude, that's a funny movie.
You saw that?
Oh, we saw that last weekend. We saw Moonrise Kingdom yesterday, and that, dude, that is really a wonderful film. Moonrise Kingdom is just absolutely delightful.
Where would you place it on Wes Anderson's filmography?
Well, we had this, because it's actually my mom, my brother, and I went to go see it, and The Life Aquatic would be the least fulfilling
mm-hmm.
Wes Anderson's film. And I like The Life Aquatic, but I would have to say it's his, of all of his films, that's the one that sort of doesn't hold up the best. Everything else does. Moonrise Kingdom is up there. It's wildly ambitious and wildly good.
Good.
I mean, extremely well done, and just absolutely delightful. And also, I mean, he is in his comfort zone. I'm not going to beat around the bush, but it's what he does in his comfort zone that's even astounding sometimes,
mm-hmm.
someone like that. So it's a really good movie. But Hysteria is actually very good, too. I really enjoyed that. That's another wonderful film. So it's actually been a very good time for the smaller movies as well as the bigger movies.
I rewatched Malcolm X last night because I went and I bought a bunch of Blu-rays from Best Buy there, and one of the specials Best Buy had was half off all the Warner Brothers book
oh, cool.
Blu-ray combos.
Oh, cool.
It's been many years since I've seen it, so I went back and revisited, and they had a good new documentary on the making of it on there. It's an astounding movie. It really is. The one complaint I have about it.
Okay, what is it? I'm curious. No, what is that?
The movie is so timeless in the telling of its grand sweeping story.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was a mistake to put Rodney King in the opening credits.
It dates the film, unfortunately.
Yeah, it really does. And that was like a last minute, because that had just occurred, I think, right before the movie came out. So that was really a last minute addition.
Mm-hmm.
That was prescient, very current and on everyone's mind.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great incendiary way of starting that movie. But it doesn't work now, I don't think. it was put in for a kind of immediate reaction, and,
yeah.
and it loses its punt. Well, I mean, it's still a tragic event, but
right, of course.
But
no, I know exactly what you're saying. I know all too well. It's something that Spike Lee is renowned for, but it doesn't. It's unfortunate. It's unfortunate because the movie is. I mean, remember Vincent Canby's review when that came out? It's every bit as epic as Lawrence of Arabia. Was the thing that he used in his movie. But when you do put something so current at the time in a movie of that magnitude, you do date the movie, unfortunately.
Yeah. And I know why he put it in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because
the
struggle still exists. But JFK had just come out, and Warner Brothers was working with Spike Lee and Malcolm X, and he said, and JFK did very well, and he said, my movie's going to be just as long, if not longer, than JFK. They had a problem with that. They had a problem with something like $6 or $7 extra million dollars that he budgeted for that
mm-hmm.
they wouldn't give him. So it was a struggle to make that movie work.
Oh, yeah.
But that brings us to something.
Okay.
This will be our list tonight, I guess. Because tomorrow night I'm doing Jason's show, and he's doing the best, our favorite films of the 1990s.
Okay.
It was easy finding my top five favorites for the 90s, actually. And then I put together some obscure titles, and I'll go through some of those in a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought this would be good and of interest to our YouTube viewers, too. We can post this on YouTube because they like lists.
Right.
to go through, here's one list. I'll go through their top 10 real quick. It's aboutfilm.com. This is their favorite films of the 1990s.
Okay.
The best of the 1990s. Their number 10 is Unforgiven.
Okay.
Their number 9 is Babe.
Okay. So far, so good. No, Babe, definitely Babe changed, is a game. Babe may be more of a game changer than Unforgiven. I mean...
Well, yeah, and Babe is, obviously we're talking about the pig movie.
Not the Babe Ruth movie with John Goodman.
Yeah. Yeah, not that one. That wasn't Ron Shelton's best hour. That did he make that, or did he make Cobb? He made Cobb, I know.
Cobb, I think he did. I don't know about the Babe. I don't remember who made the Babe.
No, he didn't make Babe. Okay. Strike that Ron Shelton.
Strike
Cobb.
That Robert Goodman.
Cobb was wrong, Ron Shelton, right. Their number 8 is L.A. Confidential.
Okay.
Yeah. Very good movie.
Awesome movie.
Number 7, Dead Man Walking.
That's a bold movie to put there. Good for them. Okay.
I like Dead Man Walking. That was actually one of my favorite years in movies, 1995.
Mm-hmm.
It was
a great year.
Smoke came out then. The Dead Man Walking, Leaving Las Vegas, Heat.
7. Casino.
Yeah.
Waterworld.
I love that year. What'd you say, Waterworld?
I said Waterworld. but a movie, a good movie did come out a week before Waterworld. Clueless. Clueless came out the week before Waterworld. That was good.
Yeah. Good. It kind of describes the production of Waterworld. Number 6, Pulp Fiction. That was a
you
game
gotta
measure.
Have a Tarantino in there.
Yeah. Django Unchained trailer is supposed to be on Prometheus.
But it wasn't on the preview, though?
No, they don't play.
No, I thought they might. I thought they might, but okay.
Number 5, The Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, that's got to be there.
Number 4, Titanic.
Okay.
Yeah. Number 3, good, nice, this is a bold choice. Number 3, Miller's Crossing.
Hell yeah, okay.
Ah, where would you put that on? Is that one of the very best Coen brothers?
That's a good... I mean, with the exception of Lady Killers, I mean, is there a bad Coen brothers? I mean...
No.
I mean, all right, I know people would probably put Intolerable Cruelty in the lesser category, but, I mean, you have something like... I mean, in the 90s, you have Fargo, Miller's Crossing, and The Big Lebowski, so...
Yeah.
I mean, that's right there. I mean, wow.
Their number 2 is Schindler's List.
Okay. All right.
And their number 1, what do you think their number 1 is for the 1990s?
Goodfellas.
You're absolutely right. That's it.
Yeah, you can't. I mean, Goodfellas is, at the time at least, Goodfellas is the anti-Godfather. Not in a bad way, just like a realistic version of the mob at the time. But it's also just brilliant storytelling and filmmaking, too.
Oh, yeah.
It's all
about it. Yeah, and it gives you a view and a feel into that life that you've never had before. I mean, just the detail of that film feels very lived in and very authentic. Okay, so here's some of the more obscure titles that I came up with from the 90s.
Okay.
Limbo, John Sayles' Limbo, which is my favorite John Sayles of that period. He made a lot of great movies in the 90s. But
that's
Limbo,
99, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm drawn to Limbo.
Okay, no, that's very interesting, though. You go to, you have obviously Lone Star and Men with Guns, but you go to Limbo. That's fascinating. Okay, cool.
Well, I know Lone Star is like a very one of the most highly acclaimed of Sayles films.
Mm-hmm. And rightfully so. But Limbo is a bold choice. Okay, now you really got my interest piqued here. Okay,
it's one of those movies where absolutely you don't know where it's going, and it could play as one kind of adventure, lost in the wilderness movie, and it kind of avoids those cliches at every turn, and you actually don't know how this movie is going to develop.
Okay, all right.
And very seldom that you see a movie like that. The Music of Chance, another one.
That's a great Paul, based on a Paul Auster novel, yeah.
Another one, yeah. Smoke, The Music of Chance, that's great. The Paul Auster double feature. And Music of Chance is James Spader and Mandy Patinkin, Stankin' Patinkin. A Simple Plan, which is Sam Raimi's film.
Mm-hmm. That's a great, great book and a great movie, yeah.
Great haunting movie.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like Sam Raimi to go back to making a smaller movie like that.
I don't know when that's going to happen.
I don't know either. But it's he gives it this kind of menacing inevitability. Very kind of it's unusual. I mean, it's singular to him, to his style.
Mm-hmm.
Brings out something very special in the material. She's So Lovely.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
John Cassavetes' screenplay, unproduced, that his son picked up and made into a movie. Sean Penn and John Travolta.
That's a good movie, too, yeah.
Really good, sensitive Sean Penn performance.
Mm-hmm.
One of the few real big standouts for Travolta post Pulp Fiction, because he worked like a maniac right after Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, and Get Shorty, I would think would be his two.
Yeah. I mean, he was coming out with. Remember, I think White Man's Burden was already in the can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
And they released that to capitalize on the Pulp Fiction resurgence.
Right.
And then Mad City wasn't entirely successful. Here's a real oddity. But I love this movie because it's just, it's balls out crazy, this movie.
Okay, now, all right, what is it?
Everybody Wins.
Oh, yeah. That's early. That's the 1990.
It's like Nick Nolte, Deborah Winger.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's an Arthur Miller screenplay.
Yeah, it's based on an Arthur Miller screenplay, yeah.
And Deborah Winger just plays a nut. I mean, it's a great, odd movie. Guilty by Suspicion, Robert De Niro.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one, yeah.
A blacklisted filmmaker. A great sense of kind of Hollywood history at that time.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a very good movie. It's a good movie.
Yeah, it's a good De Niro performance too, I think, and it's kind of early Annette Bening in
mm-hmm,
that movie.
That's
well.
Right.
Citizen Ruth, Alexander Payne's first film.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one.
Funny, that movie. Once Around.
Oh, that's right, with Richard Dreyfuss and Laura San Giacomo, yeah.
Richard Dreyfuss, yes. that's a good, challenging movie, and not a predictable movie. I mean,
no, not at all.
Those characters feel very unique in that movie. In terms of best, I mean, my favorites, Wild at Heart, JFK,
mm-hmm.
Heat, Casino, Wild
mm-hmm.
at Heart. I love Bridges of Madison County.
No, that's a good one, too.
I love the Spike Lee trio of Summer of Sam, Malcolm X, and He Got Game.
Those are all good movies.
I love Jerry Maguire. I love Cape Fear, Seven, Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me, and The Insider, and Presumed Innocent.
Mm-hmm. Presumed Innocent's a good movie. I wish, you know what, there's a sequel. You know, he wrote a sequel to Presumed Innocent, and I don't know if they made it, because he made a lot of Scott Turow's books in the miniseries after Presumed Innocent. But I would love to see Harrison Ford come back. I know, well, obviously the director can't come back, but I'd love to see Harrison Ford portray that character again.
Yeah, it's like the last great Alan Pakula movie. Presumed Innocent, just a great...
What followed Presumed Innocent? We had the Devil's Own.
Devil's Own, yeah.
Consenting Adults. What else?
I think that's it. I think he closed out on Devil's Own, actually.
I think you're right. Okay.
And he was making Consenting Adults, and he knew that movie was beneath him. And this comes from the screenwriter of Devil's Own that we talked to, and he said, you know, I just want to practice my craft. That's why I'm doing this movie. Some other interesting movies that maybe don't get talked about a lot. Remember that movie Revenge?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with Anthony Quinn and Kevin Costner, yeah.
Yeah. Tony Scott,
yes.
A lot of testosterone there. Bugsy's a great movie.
Mm-hmm. Bugsy's awesome.
Glengarry Glenn Ross is 20 years old this year.
Dude, I feel old when you guys say this stuff to me, man. I feel so old.
20 years old.
Okay,
wow.
Why don't you say it one more time, Jamie?
I'm going to say it again.
No, you're not. No, please.
You are 20 years older than the first time you saw Glengarry Glenn Ross.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for saying that.
I mean, Spike Lee did a lot of great stuff in the 90s. Mo Better Blues, his documentary Four Little Girls.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God, heartbreaking. The Rainmaker is a great Coppola Grisham.
That is one of the... that's a very underappreciated film.
I think so, too. What do you think of Evita?
I think Antonio Banderas is incredible in it. I think the tragedy of the movie is, why isn't Madonna better in it?
Mm.
That's my thing. I mean, I think that I have the soundtrack. I saw the movie. I like the movie, but the thing that kind of always shocked me is, why isn't Madonna more... this is a part that she was born to play. Let's be very frank here. This was made for her. And she doesn't come off... she comes off... it's underwhelming. But Antonio Banderas is just magnificent.
Yeah, he's a revelation in it.
He's
yeah.
magnificent. But why isn't she...
well...
better? That's my thing.
She's not much of an actress.
No, she's not much of an actress, but let's look at something like... she's good in Desperately Seeking Susan. I don't think anyone would dispute that. But the movies have eluded her.
Yeah, I don't think she's that capable.
Right.
Now, I think that she did her best singing in Evita.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because she's never been the greatest singer.
Right.
But you could tell she did a lot of work on her voice in that, and working with Sondheim on Dick Tracy.
Mm-hmm. She is good in Dick Tracy. I like her in Dick Tracy. I think that's another good performance from her.
Yeah. Well, her vocals, I think, are really great in Evita.
Mm-hmm.
I like Evita. I actually like Evita a lot. And the look of it, Darius Kunjai, cinematographer. Mm-hmm. Oliver Stone originally wanted to do it and cast Michelle Pfeiffer in the lead.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was really sore that they chose Alan Parker. He didn't get along with Alan Parker. And that goes back to Midnight Express, I think.
Right.
So he has nothing but bad things to say about Alan Parker. But I sent a request to Oliver Stone, so hopefully we'll get him.
Oliver Stone making Savages into a movie. You know, a lot of people think, why is he doing... I read Savages last summer. He's perfect for it. If you look at Salvador, and you also look at the book that he wrote, that novel he wrote,
A Child Knight's Dream.
Yeah, Savages fits in perfectly to the protagonist's view of life, and also just Oliver Stone. I mean, it's perfect material for him.
Right.
Forget all that. Just look at Natural Born Killers. And there is I think it's wonderful. I think there's a movie that Oliver Stone could really show everyone, I still got it, and I haven't grown up completely, you know, and it's a fascinating story, and I think I really can't wait to see it. It looks good.
I'm looking forward to it, too.
Yeah, and I mean, it looks really good.
And I really, really want to talk to him, so hopefully he'll
say everyone. Yes. I mean,
hopefully he'll say yes to our interview request.
Please say yes, Oliver Stone, please.
He needs to do Movie Geeks United. Let's start a campaign.
Yeah, he really does. There's no reason. There's no excuse at this point. No, but this movie looks perfect. This movie, I think, could... This movie, given the subject matter and given the characters and just the world view of the movie, fits in perfectly to the young Oliver Stone.
Yeah.
And I hope that's what he saw.
I hope so, because that's what we've been fighting to get back to.
That, Ollie.
Yeah. Quiz Show. Great,
I love that movie.
I love it too. Great Paul movie. Scofield. Oh.
That movie's awesome. I love that movie so much.
Yeah, and that father-son relationship is the centerpiece of that movie between Ralph Fiennes and Scofield.
I agree.
Just beautiful, beautiful. Of course, Boogie Nights would have to be. It would be on your list, I know.
It'll be on my list. I mean, Magnolia is 99, so I would put that. But Boogie Nights definitely has to be there. But the Ice Storm, I'd have to put in there too.
The Ice Storm, well, yes, yeah, yeah.
Here's another movie I'd have to put in there from the 90s. I mean, I agree with everything you've put, and I think you would put, if you had time, Reservoir Dogs, obviously, there.
Mm-hmm.
I would have to put Romeo's Bleeding.
I got that on here, yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting...
I don't
Lena Olin is one of the great vixens.
Mm-hmm. She's so good in that, and he is good in that. Another movie I have to... It's The Professional.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Put that in there. That's a great 90s film.
Of course, Anaconda's on. You know, I just listed, like, movies that I love from the
90s. Yeah, no, I don't. Yeah, I mean, but it was a great decade for movies. It was a wonderful decade for movies.
And beyond my top five, I haven't placed them yet.
Right.
I love The Thomas Crown Affair.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one, yeah.
I love Ian McKellen's Richard III.
That's an awesome movie.
Yeah. And on the flip side of that, I obviously love Pacino's Looking for Richard.
That's a very good movie. It's a good documentary. Very good documentary.
Yeah, it is. And that's a good double feature. I like Leap of Faith, which they just made into a musical.
Mm-hmm.
Of all
very
movies.
Very underappreciated.
Of all movies, Leap of Faith, the Broadway musical.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not going to capitalize on the film because the film, I mean, nobody knows it. I mean, it was a major flop. It was a holiday release that nobody went to see.
Right, that's true, yeah.
Steve Martin, Liam Neeson, another Deborah Winger, Leap of Faith. This Boy's Life, the resurgence of De Niro as the great, powerful actor that he is. It came back in This Boy's Life, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Night in the City, actually, I like too.
Mm-hmm.
Erwin Kirshner's Night in the City.
Right.
I like him in that movie. Postcards from the Edge is a great movie.
Mm-hmm.
The Hard Way is a lot of fun.
Yes, it is, yeah.
I Love You to Death is a lot of fun.
That's a good one.
And I like Mother, and I like Notting Hill. Like, Notting Hill is my favorite of those. Well, I like Love Actually, and I like Notting Hill. But Love Actually was in the 2000s, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, so you can get away with it. No, but Notting Hill was very good. Very good. Very enjoyable movie.
In the Company of Men.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Life is Beautiful. Did you like Life is Beautiful?
Yes, I did. I did.
Did you like I'll Do Anything?
Yes, I did. I gotta be honest with you. I have not seen it in a very, very long time, but I did like it though.
It's amazing how totally compromised that movie is.
Mm-hmm.
To have started out as a musical, and then taken out all the music.
I know.
And that it still works as well as it does. I mean, that movie has great character moments that come through with the writing. Private Parts.
Now, there's the movie that everyone thought, you know, Howard Stern thought he would be, that would be it. It would be the biggest movie ever, and it wasn't. But it has its moments, though. There's no doubt about it.
It does. It did well. I liked it.
This is the thing I like about it. He comes off so much nicer in the movie than you would ever think.
Yeah.
that's what I like about it. He comes off as a real human being. It's not just like loud obscenities. He really comes off as a real character. That's what I liked about it.
Absolutely. And if you think about him, I mean, in his real life, he's not, I mean, there's no controversy in his life.
No, none.
Outside of his show.
Yeah, that's the amazing thing. That's an excellent point about him today. That's a superb point.
And you can point to a lot of holier than thous that have criticized Howard Stern, and they have scandal in their lives.
Yeah, they do, but he does not.
Yeah. And I guess finally, I mean, there's a lot of other movies on this list, but finally, here's a movie that I think is actually another hidden treasure. I put it there with Smoke. It's another movie starring William Hurt, and that's The Doctor.
That's
I love
The
Doctor.
Very good, that movie.
The Doctor is amazingly emotional and smart about character, and not obvious, like very subtle. And I'm crazy about that movie, actually. Rhonda Haynes. Where does she go? Children of a Lesser God, The Doctor, Rambling Rose.
And doesn't she do Wrestling Ernest Hemingway? Is that her too, or?
Yes.
And
yeah.
What's after that? Is there anything after that, or?
Maybe, but I mean, those were the major four.
Mm-hmm.
And then she, I mean, not another high profile movie. I actually wrote to her years ago.
I remember this, yeah.
And she said she was out of the country doing a workshop of some kind. But I've always been fascinated in hearing about these films that she's worked on.
Mm-hmm.
She just Dance With Me. She did Dance With Me with Vanessa Williams. It's 98. It's the last film she directed.
Yeah, she did TV movies. I'm looking at The Outsider and the Ron Clark Story, but yeah.
Right. Yeah, this is great. Some of those great movies. But The Doctor has always been my favorite of all of those.
Mm-hmm.
But Wrestling Ernest Hemingway is good, too.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of it. The Doctor, Wrestling Ernest, Dance. But yeah, that's right. She did Dance. God, that's a long time, though. And
Donnie Brasco. No, she didn't do Donnie Brasco.
No, but Donnie Brasco, that's another underappreciated film. We always talk about it on the show, but let's be honest. People don't talk about that movie that much.
Well, another movie that's not appreciated that I love from the 90s is Meet Joe Black.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've always loved that. But my top five weren't hard. I mean, Wild at Heart has to be the top.
Right, yeah.
JFK, Heat, Casino. I don't know what that, I'm hearing that static on the phone. JFK, Heat, Casino, Eyes Wide Shut.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, that's an impressive bunch of movies.
That is.
Okay, we'll talk movie news because there's a lot of movie headlines that we haven't talked about tonight, but we'll talk about those Wednesday when we bring on Roger Donaldson, director.
Wow.
He's not coming on to talk about a new movie. He's coming on to talk about one of his older movies that's making its Blu-ray debut on Tuesday, Tom Cruise's Cocktail. The Hippie Hippie Shake. We'll be doing it with Roger Donaldson on Wednesday. And stick to our Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, our website for the latest news about the show and upcoming guests, twitter.com/MovieGeeksUnite, facebook.com/MovieGeeksUnited, youtube.com/MovieGeeksUnited, or our official website, MovieGeeksUnited.net. All right, Jerry.
All right.
I had a good time. Thank
Likewise,
you.
Likewise. It was a lot of fun.
We closed the show with Jake Hartley and Joe Gressis. They are two of the principal players in Secret Handshake Entertainment. They've started a new contest. It's called the Collaboration Filmmakers Challenge. A bunch of filmmakers, some of them have already broken into the industry somewhat. Some of them are amateurs. They're getting together, they're collaborating, and then they're competing against one another to produce a series of short films that will be judged by a celebrity panel. This is going on right now. You can find out more information about the contest at collaborationchallenge.com. So here they are talking about their movie or their contest. All I got to do is find the file. Where's the file? Here it is. Okay. And then right after their segment, we'll close out with a piece of score from the new film, Hysteria. So we'll see you back on Wednesday. Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you. Have a good night, everyone.
Good night. Let's talk a little bit about Secret Handshake Entertainment. Joe, you founded this with a partner in 2007. What led to...
I guess it's more like 2008, but yes, somewhere in that vicinity.
Okay. Well, and what led to the conception of it?
You know, just at some point you have to make that leap of faith. That's just the way the industry... That's the way any industry works, really. It's like you can work for other people for a certain amount of time, but if you want to be able to, you know, do what you kind of dreamed of, you have to at some point just do it for yourself. So, you know, I certainly liked the world of editing and post-production, which I'd been doing, but, you know, if I was ever going to get more to writing and producing and directing, I had to start it myself. And so that was kind of the idea. And so my partner, you know, same boat, exactly, pretty much. It's just like, you know, you work for other people long enough, eventually you have to... Either you resign yourself to that, or you make a leap of faith.
And so it you guys develop projects, and oftentimes you guys come in on post production and shepherd it to the end. And is that what you guys do?
Yeah, I mean we get involved in all kinds of phases of the process. I mean sometimes from development all the way through production and post, which is what we did on A Little Help, for example, and sometimes. Sometimes we come in at the end or somewhere in the middle. You know, it's like we have the ability to kind of deal with a project at all phases. So it's just kind of a lot of times it's what comes our way that interests us.
And when you think about what you want the personality of your company to be, in terms of the projects you choose to nurture. How would you describe that?
Probably like the drunk uncle who won't leave a party.
I think that's great.
Yeah, no, well, that might not be exactly true. No, you know what? It's definitely not necessarily looking to be the biggest or most commercial kind of projects, but certainly something that's going to be interesting and have a unique wrinkle, but generally speaking within a genre, like a kind of, you know, more known genre. So, you know, it's like because I do tend to like science fiction and horror and, you know, things of that nature. The web series I'm working on now is, you know, a hybrid of anime and live action. So, you know, a bunch of, a lot of things interest me. And so I think the idea is to be eclectic. So maybe some kind of a, you know, painter that you run into who actually does it and is not pretentious about it.
Yeah, yeah. So the Collaboration Filmmakers Challenge.
Yeah.
That's why you guys are here. How did this begin? What were the seeds of this idea for you guys?
Well, it began with talking to somebody who worked at a foundation and more or less had put on seminars for people to hear industry professionals and hopefully, you know, meet and speak with each other and, you know, strike up relationships and then work together towards the future. And I remember talking to the head of this foundation. I said, you know, it seems to me if you want people to work together, a great way is to have them work together. And so she's like, well, that's a good idea. Maybe you should write it up. And so I put together a proposal for the film festival and for this film challenge, and there you go. And so it has a it does have this collaboration element, which is a fairly unique one from what I can see, where you know, we have people who sign up for the competition team up with other people that they might not have met and or should not have met at this point, generally speaking, unless, you know, luck can play a factor. Hopefully, you know, they will actually work on these projects together and hopefully create some kind of a relationship, or relationships will come out of this festival to stretch into the future.
Mm. So this, I think it began, the orientation began yesterday, Jay?
Yesterday, yes. That's correct.
So tell me what the process is. I mean, where are they now and where are they going to be by the end of this journey?
Well, right now they are in the development phase. And so what we did yesterday is we released the theme for this year, and they will go and create 5 pitches based on this idea. And then they will submit them to us, and we will kind of use our experience as a producing company to review those submissions and select which one they should actually go with. And so at the beginning of their week, the filmmakers are either assigned, you know, to week 1 or week 2, at the beginning of their week, they'll be given their assigned pitch and they'll run with it, and they'll have exactly 1 week to go from development all the way through post-production. So, you know, after Memorial Day, it'll start, and then 2 weeks after that, we will have a bunch of, you know, 3 to 5 minute short films. I'm excited to see what comes of it.
Wow. And it all culminates in there's a screening that takes place at the end of this process in around mid-June, and it's they're judged, correct?
Yes. And we have some fantastic judges. I'm actually really excited about who we have. We have Tim Minear, who is one of the creators of Firefly, one of Joss Whedon's constant collaborators. He's also a writer on American Horror Story. We have Michael Whitehorn, creator of King of Queens, and writer-director of A Little Help. We have film critic Kurt Loder, who, you know, most people know pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And then, let's see, we have Ray Miller, who is from Archetype, and he represents a lot of, directors and writers. And we thought that was that was an important element of this, is to make sure that we have people who represent writers and directors. And, you know, because it's like, ideally we want people to really see this. We want people who could help their careers actually see these movies. And then we also have from Zero Gravity Entertainment, which is my management company. They represent me. Andrew Wilson, who represents filmmakers like Toby Hooper and Clive Barker.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that is an exciting panel of judges.
Yeah, I feel great about it, yeah.
That's terrific. So how did the participants, how were they chosen? How did they come on board?
Well, the participants all, through our website, submit an application. They were recruited very heavily through a lot of grassroots stuff, you know, young filmmakers that we know and talented organizations. We have, for example, a lot of people from Second City, Groundlings, you know, all over the place, very successful, established people who work in casting, production. I mean, there's a dangerous mix in this group, and one of the things that I think is pretty interesting about it is that, you know, you have people who are exceptional as filmmakers for a variety of reasons, whether that's, you know, a sense of humor or technical prowess or even a social conscience, but you put these people in a room together and they gravitate toward each other. At the same time, they're competing with each other. Mm. So, you know, I think the fact that they're going to be competing against each other but also collaborating and using each other as resources is going to result in some really good films.
I think so, too. And it those different types of strengths that they all bring to the table, they can only benefit one another, I think, too.
That's the idea.
Yeah. So it also gives them an opportunity to kind of brush shoulders with talent representatives and build a network, because I find that a lot of times creative people aren't necessarily the best at being very aggressive at selling themselves necessarily.
For sure.
Yeah, so this gives them a great opportunity to be in the room with some very influential people.
Yeah, and I think this is also, same with the collaboration, is it like, you know, we're creating a forum where people kind of have to work with people they don't necessarily know, and, you know, that's something that a lot of them wouldn't do on their own, but really has a potential to, be beneficial for everybody.
Wow. So the contest ends, the screening takes place on June 22nd, and that's after the kind of grueling period of whittling down a concept and filming it and having these individual short films screen. I'm sure you guys want this to be an ongoing annual competition, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So where do our listeners go to read more about it and apply for next year's event?
Well, the best place to go is the website, which is www.collaborationchallenge.com. At this point, you know, as far as next year, we wouldn't be, we're not in the, you know, the stage of taking applications on it quite yet.
Right.
But that would definitely be the place to go for updates and also to follow you know, just the progress of this contest, because once we have the winners, we'll be putting that up and people will get to see, you know, hopefully what will motivate people in the years to come will be, you know, they'll get to see who walked away with the $8,000 in cash prizes that we're going to be offering, as well as a number of really great prizes from our corporate sponsors.
Thank you.